From New Jersey to Texas, Florida to South Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it is a health crisis affecting millions of Americans, and the number of deaths from opioid abuse have skyrocketed. David Chase of Health Rosetta is here to talk about the crisis and what steps must be taken to deal with it. And Congress normally takes a rather lengthy summer recess, but not this year. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on what business awaits our elected representatives. Anytime government tinkers with the economy, there are unintended consequences. And so it is with the Trump administration's tariffs. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at some of the problems. And affirmative action began in the 1960s, but on his American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why it is now hurting the very people it was intended to help. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The number of Americans addicted to and dying from opioids is astounding. David Chase, co-founder of Health Rosetta, has written a book which details the systemic changes that must be made to deal with that epidemic. The book is entitled The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call. Healthcare is Stealing the American Dream. Here's how we take it back. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, when we talk about the opioid crisis, it, of course, has received a lot of attention nationwide. It's a major healthcare concern. Tell us a bit about what opioids are and what is the scope of this crisis?
The opioids are a class of medication that basically molecularly is virtually identical to heroin. And the drugs that you'd be familiar with would be things like OxyContin, Percocet, Vicodin. There's a whole class of so-called opioids. And many people now consider the opioid crisis to be the largest public health crisis in the U.S. in the last 100 years, if you measure it by number of deaths. So it's really quite dramatic. And unfortunately, it's unlike, you know, something like polio or Ebola or something like that. This is actually a self-inflicted wound by the system. And so that makes it particularly uniquely challenging and also shines a light on a broader dysfunction that we need to all be aware of.
How are people becoming addicted to these opioids, David? You say it's self-inflicted. Is it something that people deliberately set out to do, or are they prescribed these medications and then find themselves hooked on them?
Generally the latter. And so if you look at most of the overdose deaths, they started with a prescription opioid. And most of the time, they were following doctor's orders. They had a very, very common situation is lower back pain. And even though there's basically no evidence that opioids are the best approach to lower back pain, they're very commonly prescribed. And essentially, when you are prescribed an opioid and when you're on it for a week, and generally, people are given 30 to 60 day supplies, whether it's for something like a back pain or maybe after surgery. After a week, it's essentially Russian roulette, where one out of six people will become addicted while they were following doctor's orders. Now, there's also an issue where because there's such a large volume of pills, people stop using them, they sit in medicine cabinets, and then some people will self-medicate or there will be some people who will use them recreationally. That tends to be something that kids have done and then kind of fallen into that trap of addiction. So yeah, those are kind of the dynamics there.
You referenced in an op-ed that you published recently that the opioid epidemic is what you call a microcosm of a broader dysfunction within the U.S. healthcare system. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, if you look at the underlying drivers of it, it really, you know, I came to the conclusion that the crisis isn't an anomaly at all. It is a logical byproduct. In fact, there's another one sort of waiting in the wings that benzos, which are things like Valium and Xanax, are where the opioid crisis was 10 years ago. And so I'll just give you one example of how it is a microcosm. we've done virtually everything imaginable to undermine primary care in this country, and I know of no high-function healthcare system in the world that isn't built on the foundation of proper primary care. And so you have this dynamic where to hit quote-unquote productivity targets when you're in this volume-centric healthcare system that most primary care doctors are finding themselves in, something that's very easy to do to get people out, because if you have to get people in and out in 7 or 8 minutes, you look for your exit strategy if you're a doctor. And prescribing is one of those exit strategies, along with things like referring or ordering tests and so on. And then you couple that with, unfortunately, a lot of primary care docs were given bad information that opioids weren't addictive, and a lot of their medical information is coming from people with a vested interest. Then here you had something that was essentially that microcosm that I was referring to. And there's a whole host of other issues that come out of an undermined primary care system. And the opioid issue is just one of them.
You also talk a bit about the sharing of information. And what we see in our healthcare system currently is that information tends to be isolated in various silos based upon if it's a workers' comp claim, if it's something coming from a primary care physician or another source. What can be done to better share information so that you don't have a patient become addicted and then just simply go from source to source to source to source to get the drugs?
That is a critical issue, is in a lot of cases, there's three separate places where claims go. You mentioned two of them. There's the medical claims, there's the workers' comp claims, and then there's the pharmacy claims. And so what you see with the folks who are tackling this successfully, they bring that together. And then they say, gosh, is there actually a condition that would warrant an opioid prescription? And if there's not, then they can flag that. You know, there might be a good explanation. A lot of times there isn't. And the other flow of information that often gets overshadowed here is a lot of people are aware that you can Google your doctor's name and find out how much money they earned or were paid to speak at an event put on by a pharmaceutical company or write something or consult or whatever. And that's fine. That's the law. And what's not done that's just as potentially impactful is the flow of money within the supply chain of the opioids. And so the way in which money flows to, for example, the pharmacy benefits managers, who a lot of employers outsource their pharmacy benefits too, those dollars are not transparent and are not shared, and they have every bit as much impact as the clinical side of it. So that's another area where flow of information and sunshine would be very helpful.
We have again been talking with Dave Chase, who is co-founder of Health Rosetta. He's also author of an upcoming book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call: Healthcare is Stealing the American Dream, and Here is How We Take It Back. Dave, if folks would like to learn more, where can they go to access information on Health Rosetta, on your writings, and when will the book be available?
You can go to healthrosetta.org, and then for your listeners, if you go /friends, you can actually download my book for free. There's the current book that's already out there that you would be able to get today. And there's a chapter, basically the last chapter, that picks up this opioid issue. And then the next book is coming out on Labor Day. And if you've downloaded the last book, we'll actually give you an early ability to download that, because we're more interested in getting the word out than a few lost book sales. So you can actually download the whole thing free, and it'll give you options to purchase if you prefer to do that. And it really uncovers the issues that we've talked about here in terms of how it's a microcosm. And the good news in this is what we really believe and what we've found is every structural problem to fix healthcare has actually already been invented, proven, and modestly replicated. Our challenge is, how do we massively replicate that? And that's really the book tells that story, and how employers and how communities and how school districts and manufacturers and so on have actually kind of slayed the beast, so to speak. So while it sounds kind of negative, it's really a story of redemption.
David Chase, author of the upcoming book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call, and also co-founder of Health Rosetta. David, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure being on. Thanks for the opportunity.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Things are a bit still in Washington, D.C. this past week, but they're about to heat up in a major way. Andy, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Normally, Andy, the Congress, the House and the Senate, takes a very long summer recess, especially in an election year, which we are in. The Senate, at least, is not going to do that this year. What is the press of business?
A lot of things, actually. There's the budget that they need to work on, especially because Trump has issued a veto threat saying you can't keep doing what you've been doing, which is these big omnibus bills. And the only way to avoid those is for Congress to do its job, which requires them to pass all of these various spending bills separately. And back in the old days when they used to do their job, it took all of the summer to do it. And so that's a big thing. Then there's the farm bill, which is working its way through Congress. And then lastly, confirmations. No help from the Democrats, but there are a lot of judges that need to be confirmed. There are a lot of cabinet positions that need to be confirmed. And the Democrats are able to slow that process down through procedural efforts so that they can't get them confirmed as quickly as the Republicans would like. So they've canceled the August recess. And this is actually good news. One is that you actually get the Senate to work and you get them to confirm all of these appointments. But the nice collateral benefit from it is that the Democrats, the Senate Democrats in red districts who are trying to win re-election, they cannot spend their time back home trying to campaign and meet with voters. They'll be busy in D.C., arguably going against Trump's agenda, which will hurt them even more in November. So it's a good idea, and I'm glad that the Senate decided to cancel recess.
We will point out that there are, 23 Democrats and only about 10 or 12 Republicans up for re-election in the U.S. Senate this year?
Correct. And the key here is that there are 10 of those 23 Democrats in states that Trump won. And some of them he won big, like in West Virginia and North Dakota and in Montana. But there are others, like Ohio and Missouri. So those 10 states are considered the ones where Republicans have the best chances of picking up seats.
As you've mentioned, there are a number of appointees to the federal courts that are awaiting Senate confirmation. Hopefully, by having the Senate in session through August, some of that backlog will be cleared. The big battle, though, is going to be over the confirmation of a justice to the seat being vacated by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who has retired. What happens after the president makes his nomination?
There'll be a lot of hoopla about the nominee. There'll be a lot of press coverage. There'll be a lot of digging into that nominee's background, into their judicial opinions, and what kind of judge or justice that this person's going to be. There are a couple of them that have already been confirmed in the past to lower courts. So the Senate has voted on them already. So there arguably won't be a lot of surprises. But then the nominee will then have to go to various senators' offices, probably all of them, in fact, sit down and answer their questions. And then, of course, he or she will be brought forth to the Senate Judiciary Committee for testimony. And that will be turned into an absolute circus. I'm sure the Democrats will have fun grandstanding in front of the national public. And then ultimately, they'll bring it to a vote on the floor of the Senate. And that person, I believe, will likely get confirmed. And this will all occur sometime late summer or early fall ahead of the election. So frankly, it's great timing politically. The obvious thing is that it's going to be a wonderful addition to the court, and it will solidify a conservative majority for the foreseeable future. So I think it's great.
You mentioned the fact that it's likely going to solidify the conservative majority. We, of course, as conservatives, have been disappointed in the past. Justice Souter comes to mind as someone who we thought would be conservative, turned out to be anything. But what is it this time around, Andy, that gives rise to optimism that whomever the president appoints or the president's appointee will, in fact, go forth and be a conservative.
Yeah, I think what Trump did is something that I'm very hopeful becomes a lasting tradition with Republican presidents. And that is, as a candidate, he compiled a list, a very public list of people he would likely choose from to be the next Supreme Court justice. And he did that with Neil Gorsuch. And that list was compiled by members of the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, two respected organizations here in D.C. And so the vetting has kind of already occurred, at least from a conservative perspective. We all remember when George Bush appointed Harriet Myers, and that was turned out to be a disaster. She withdrew her name, and thankfully we avoided another suitor. But with this list, we believe that all of them are sufficiently conservative and that any one of them would be a fine choice to be confirmed and appointed to the Supreme Court.
Well, next week we will talk more about the president's pick for that Supreme Court justice seat and also keep a very close eye on what happens in the Senate over the summer as they continue work. Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic liberty. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll chat with you next week.
Thanks for having me, Lumen.
The imposition of tariffs creates economic winners and losers. This past week, growing difficulties were experienced by car makers and other industries. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
It's been an enlightening economic experiment, but the Trump administration's plan to use tariffs to reshape global trade is now pretty much unraveling before our very eyes. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the Trump administration's trade war. That is, the administration's attempt to use tariffs to force concessions from some major U.S. trading partners. And we're going to find out just how well or how poorly that effort is going so far. Because each day right now seems to bring fresh evidence of exactly how wrong the president was to declare that trade wars are good and easy to win. Unfortunately, each day also seems to bring fresh evidence that the White House is determined to stay the course, consequences be damned. The big news last week was that several major automotive manufacturers told the administration that planned tariffs on imported cars and car parts would wreck their operations in the United States. That follows a week worth of news that a wide range of industries, from those that make motorcycles to those that make steel railings, and from those that make tires to nails, were shifting jobs overseas or postponing expansions because of the tariffs. The stock market continues to reflect the uncertainty imposed by Trump's trade policy, and even the White House's own assessment shows that economic growth will slow as the tariffs hit. But over the weekend, in defiance of the mounting evidence, Trump insisted that it's all going to work out, and on Monday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the administration will not stop the trade wars, even if the stock market tanks. There's no bright line in the stock market that's going to change policy, he told CNBC. The big question now is how much more damage will be done to the American economy and to the mechanisms of global trade before the president retreats from these misguided policies. The automotive tariffs might very well be the turning point. Trump has instructed the Commerce Department to conduct a formal investigation into whether tariffs could be applied to imported cars on the grounds that they are a national security threat. No, that doesn't make much sense. The domestic manufacturer of automobiles has no apparent correlation with U.S. national security, BMW told the Commerce Department last week in comments that were submitted as part of the department's continuing investigation into the idea of putting those tariffs on cars. In other comments submitted to the department, automakers say tariffs will increase the price of their cars, potentially by thousands of dollars, and will force industry-wide supply chain adjustments that could see American automaking jobs cut or moved overseas. Trump announced these proposed auto tariffs last month in response to European tariffs targeting American goods like motorcycles, whiskey, and blue jeans. Those tariffs, in turn, were the European Union's response to Trump's 25% import duties on steel and 10% tariffs on aluminum. That tit-for-tat escalation of the conflict between America and Europe has already claimed some victims. Harley Davidson, the Wisconsin-based motorcycle brand that also builds bikes in Missouri and Pennsylvania, announced last week that it would shift some manufacturing to Europe to avoid those EU tariffs. Building motorcycles in the U.S. and shipping them to Europe would leave customers paying about $2,000 more per bike, the company says. And shifting the jobs overseas will cost about $30 million, but that's far less than the $100 million that the tariffs could cost Harley-Davidson every year. Polaris, a Minnesota-based company, could soon follow Harley-Davidson's lead. A spokeswoman for the company told the Associated Press last week that Polaris is considering shifting production of its Indian motorcycle brand from Iowa to Poland. Harley-Davidson and Polaris could not be more explicit about the reasons they're shifting jobs overseas, and neither could any of the car companies that submitted their comments last week to the Commerce Department. As with the tariffs on steel and aluminum, and another set of tariffs targeting $50 billion in Chinese imports, Trump's proposed tariffs on cars would needlessly harm American workers while aiming to punish close allies and key trading partners. But whether Trump is aware of all that remains somewhat unclear. Last week, while giving a speech in South Carolina, the president said he wanted to erect trade barriers so car makers like BMW would have to, quote, build them here instead of shipping cars in from Germany. But BMW does indeed build them here. The company's largest manufacturing facility in the world is in Spartanburg, South Carolina, less than 100 miles from where the president was speaking at the time. The plant employs 9,000 people and produces about 40,000 vehicles every year. But ignorance can only account for so much of the White House's bullheaded approach, because the consequences of tariffs are pretty well known. Trump's tariffs would grow the steel, iron, and aluminum industries by about 33,000 jobs, according to an analysis by the Trade Partnership, a pro-trade think tank. But the tariffs would also wipe out about 179,000 other jobs. That's a loss of about 5 jobs for every 1 gained. A separate study released in March by the Coalition for a Prosperous America, a protectionist think tank that favors tariffs, also found that Trump's steel and aluminum levies would cost American jobs. U.S. manufacturing would lose about 10,000 jobs, and the construction industry would lose about 7,500, according to that report. And the White House's own analysis of the tariffs, released to little fanfare in early June, also showed, surprise, surprise, that the tariffs would raise prices and slow economic growth. All of which should be cause for some second thoughts. But for someone who promised to drain the swamp and do things differently, President Trump's response to the slow-motion failure of his trade agenda is a classic move straight out of the Washington playbook. If a government policy isn't working, you declare that that just means it hasn't been tried hard enough, and you keep going. Ross continues to downplay the potential for tariffs to hurt American jobs and tank the stock market. Those consequences, he told CNBC last week, are nothing more than hiccups. In other circumstances, there might be something admirable about the Trump administration's determination to continue full speed ahead, even as the warning lights are flashing in their faces. But the thing about this damn the torpedoes approach to trade is that sometimes the torpedoes actually hit you. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our ongoing coverage of trade and the Trump administration's tariff plans at Reason.com, and I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Affirmative action is hurting those of both races at the lower end of the economic ladder. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains how.
Affirmative action was a term first used by President Kennedy as a result of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. In an article from the National Conference of State Legislatures, they described affirmative action as, and I quote, "Affirmative action is an outcome of the 1960s civil rights movement, intended to provide equal opportunities for members of minority groups and women in education and employment." In 1961, President Kennedy was the first to use the term affirmative action in an executive order that directed government contractors to take affirmative action to ensure that applicants are employed and that employees are treated during employment without regard to race, color, creed, or national origin. The executive order also established the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity, now known as the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. End of quote. After almost 60 years of affirmative action, how do we measure the success or failure of affirmative action policies? Is it appropriate to also consider the impact on other groups who have potentially been negatively affected by affirmative action? Is there a point at which affirmative action programs can actually become discriminatory to poor blacks and the poor of all races, as well as middle-income families of those citizens not subject to affirmative action programs? After all, it's now been 60 years. When one looks at the injustices and inequity in our society, one would imagine that the goal of affirmative action would be to level the playing field for those who have been dealt with unfairly, while at the same time not disadvantaging those merely trying to get ahead. In my lifetime, I've been very fortunate to have been on both sides of our society, meaning those who have done well and those who have not. I started out in a very poor family after our dad passed away, leaving our mom with five children and little income. Our family struggled, and due to our faith, a wonderful mom, a memory of a loving dad, and hard work, all five of us prevailed and became successfully financially. Those of us born on the wrong side of the track struggled to do well and help our children succeed so that our children could experience a better life. Our parents wanted the American dream for our children, and it was attainable. I am an example. My children, though, are but one generation away from what poverty was in our family. Yet by affirmative action standards, they are privileged and now denied opportunities that people like me from poor white families fought so hard to earn. Of late, the term white privilege has been bantered about in academia, the press, and in select government agencies. The term white privilege appears to be the rallying cry, however, of whites of privilege rather than the reality of privilege for all whites. The label discriminates horrifically against poor middle income of other races who will never know the white privilege they are told they benefit from. Lower income blacks receive no such deferential treatment either, because those blacks who benefit from the restrictions on white privilege are blacks from wealthier family and not lower income black children. Affirmative action after 60 years of the experiment may distract from the real issues of poverty, lack of quality education for poor Americans regardless of race, and lack of economic opportunity. It seems intuitively obvious that in various stages of our nation's life, people were, and in many cases still are, discriminated against. That is not the complete issue, though. The issue has been made that all people who are white are privileged. And that is an absolutely absurd assertion. For instance, with affirmative action programs, former President Mrs. Obama's children will qualify as a minority for preferential admission to a university because of race. If you are white, your children will be denied that same consideration because they are white. The perception that it is the person's color that is the only basis of privilege is frequently bantered about in affluent areas where privilege does in fact exist. In government, affirmative action programs start with the premise that all persons of race are less fortunate than all persons who are white. If our nation ever hopes to solve the problem of race relations, we must solve the problems of poverty, economic opportunity, and access to quality education. Claiming the issue is just about race perpetuates poverty, poor educational opportunities, and substandard economic opportunities for those who are poor, regardless of race. For the vast majority of white people in this nation, they are struggling financially and socially as well. Affirmative action programs which fail to discern the full scope of the problem are doomed to fail. The real solutions to affirmative action are quality education and economic growth for a vibrant economic future for all citizens. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WTRV-FM in Walker, Michigan, WTWZ-FM in Jackson, Mississippi, along with WROK-AM in Rockford, Illinois. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.